Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Sudan, Darfur tragedy, and more. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Sagama by Nori and his Dropa Band. Today, Africa Now continues its focus on the conflict in Sudan. Since war broke out on April 15, 2023, in Sudan between the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF or SAF, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, led by General Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, also known as Hameti, over 13 million people have been displaced internally and externally as refugees abroad. Tens of thousands have been killed, and over 20 million people, about half the population, face acute food insecurity. Thus, because of the war, Sudan faces the world's largest humanitarian disaster. In the Darfur region of Sudan, the humanitarian crisis has intensified in the past week following the fall of Al-Fasha, the capital of North Darfur, to the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, in late October. There are reports of mass killings and countless human rights abuses. Tens of thousands of people who took refuge in Al-Fasha, fleeing other war-torn areas, have been forced to move again. Joining the show today to dissect the tragedy in Darfur and beyond is Moussa Baba of IN Network, a media outlet in Sudan, and he's also a member of the Pan-African Forum Sudan. Moussa Baba is a founding member of the Pan-African Forum Sudan and previously a member of Girfana Movement in Sudan. In recent years, Moussa Baba has been a lead consultant for the IN Network, as well as working with new civic actors after the 2019 revolution. Here is my recent conversation with Moussa Baba. Moussa Baba, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again, Moussa. Thank you for the coverage on Sudan.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk about this important tragic situation going on in Sudan. And for you, of course, it hits right, it hits home. So I wanted first to talk about Al-Fasha, which the Rapid Support Forces have taken over about a week ago. But first I want to talk about the context of Sudan's geography and history. And we did discuss this a bit some weeks ago, but to refresh the memory of how Al-Fasha plays a significant role, not just in the Darfur region, Darfur state, but in the historical context of Sudan.
Yeah, so the significance of Al-Fasha, has been the historic capital of Darfur since it was a sultanate, and its significance is that it does tie together the Jabal Marra area to northern Darfur, and it's the first stopping point from the rest of Sudan into Darfur. It's a window into the Sahel in West Africa. So there's a lot of reasons why Al-Fasha is significant, but there's the fierce battle over Al-Fasha, since the beginning of the war. It's also, it's strategic but symbolic also for the RSF to take it over. And, the civilians in Al-Fasha have carried a very heavy burden. And right now it's a massacre just like the one that was happening in Guinea and West Darfur in June 2023. Al-Fasha, even during the Darfur war days, was also a safe haven. For people who were displaced from the other war-torn areas in the countryside of North Darfur and Jabal Marra and these areas. In April of this year, the RSF attacked the Zamzam IDP camp in El Fasher, which had some people who were displaced since 2003. So you have populations in Darfur that have been displaced since 2003 and then displaced again in this war. Some of them went to Tawila in the south of Al-Fashir in the Jabal Marra area. And luckily that's controlled by the Sudan Liberation Movement led by Abdul Wahid Nur. And they haven't joined the war at all. They maintain their neutrality and they maintain a stance of peace, and they've created a safe haven for people who were escaping Al-Fashir and Niala before that. But a lot of them probably went to Eastern Chad over the border and stayed over there. But the Al-Fashir, as being the capital of Darfur, was kind of why the RSF had its crosshairs on Al-Fashir and actually encircled and trapped the people of Al-Fashir inside. Even the military groups that were in there, SAF along with the joint Darfur forces, they would get supplies by airdrop. But little by little, when the war started changing and the RSF started bringing, surface-to-air missiles and, drones and anti-aircraft artillery, they started shooting down from the, any kind of air supplies. So it's been a saga since late 2023, where, the RSF is consistently trying to take over Al-Fashir, and they were pushed back by SAF and its allied Darfur Joint Forces. And, it led to the tragedy that we're seeing today.
And you also mentioned the how it was affected in the Darfur conflict in the early 2000 in 2003. Am I correct in you said that right early in your
Yes,
when you were yes yeah and
that's
then
correct.
yeah and then so as we're looking at that, do you see this situation right now in Darfur a repeat of what happened in the early 2000s, particularly around 2003 to 2003 to 2006 or so? Do you see it rather a repeat of that, or do you see it rather as a continuation of that issue?
Yes, that's exactly what it is, Muiza. I always say that the Darfur war was never resolved because the RSF actually, the Janjaweed took over and they won. And they are the RSF right now. And basically, this is a continuation of that nightmare of, the Bashir regime unleashing the Janjaweed on the people of Darfur. And now it's just the new Janjaweed, which is the RSF. They've taken it on themselves and created kind of their own state. So they were operating as a nation within a nation for a long time right now. Now it's just official. And of course they were incubated by SAF. So, the only difference is that back then SAF was driving the Sudan Armed Forces. They were driving the genocide and they were using the Janjaweed. And now the RSF is acting on its own. So, but throughout all of these periods, the civilian in Darfur was, facing the brunt of this war and of the Janjaweed militias.
So basically, that war against people in Darfur never stopped. It just continued, and it
No.
just as intensified at certain periods. And I guess that's something that we are not discussing effectively as well. And particularly why I guess many people, apart from the Darfurians, are surprised of what has happened in Al-Fasher. Is that a correct assumption that the way they're drawing conclusions that, oh wow, this is a, this is almost like a surprise, but it's not a surprise for people in Darfur, that the
It's not,
tragedy, the
it's,
humanitarian tragedy has happened.
yeah. It's not a surprise for people in Darfur and people who've been following the war pretty closely, as well as citizens around Sudan. I mean, they've been hearing about Al-Fashir being surrounded for a year and a half. And there was almost, unless people who are kind of engulfed in the SAF propaganda, for them it was a surprise. Because the SAF propaganda was always saying that, Al-Fashir will never fall, and we have a lot of forces in there, and we've repelled the RSF time and time again. But for the people that are following it, we've seen like if the RSF was able to attack and take over the biggest IDP camp in Darfur in April 2025, and displace thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands, then it was just a matter of time until Al-Fashir itself fell. And that was the tragedy. It was like a slow motion tragedy that was happening. But you're right, a lot of people didn't see this coming. A lot of people were, convinced with the SAF propaganda that, Al-Fashir will never fall. You have the Darfur Joint Forces. They've been making noise for a while, saying that the SAF should spend more effort in liberating Al-Fashir. And SAF was just spread out, and there might have been also the lack of the lack of will to actually go over there, because it would be very difficult to get local people who are signed up to defend their areas, whether they're in northern Sudan or eastern Sudan or Sinnar and these areas, and have them cross all of this terrain to go to Al-Fashir, an unfamiliar terrain for them, where the RSF, that's their terrain, and the joint forces, the joint Darfur forces, know that's their terrain, but they need air support and they need logistics and they need all this stuff. So it's been a point of contention for a while, even within the SAF camp itself. So people who have a little bit of more clear mind about the war and what's going on weren't really surprised by it. But yeah, a lot of people did, were surprised by this. We're following kind of more of the SAF rhetoric.
Again, that's Mousav Baba. He's of IN Network. It's a media outlet in Sudan, and we're looking at the tragedy in Darfur and more in Sudan. And I wanted to just quote, there was an opinion piece in the Guardian, which actually reflects some of what you've been saying, particularly about the how people the attention span on the issue. It's from the opinion piece that was titled "Blood Spilled in Sudan Can Be Seen from Space." Nobody can feign ignorance about what's going on. That's by Nisreen Malik, and that's from the Guardian, November 3rd, a couple of days ago. And she quotes. She says in one of the things that she writes in the opinion pieces. In the opinion piece, is that Sudan's war is described as forgotten, but in reality, it's tolerated and regulated. If you could expand on what she's saying by that, and but what from what I've just heard you say or acknowledge, you agree with that.
Yes, I do. I do. She's spot on when it comes to that, because the warring parties were are both, their geopolitical connections are part of the US allies' sphere of influence. So if you take SAF, it's supported mainly by Egypt, and you take the RSF, it's supported mainly by the UAE. So any way you cut it up, all of this mayhem and destruction is coming from one kind of coalition that is basically pro-US, pro-Israel. And that's one of the main reasons why the Sudan war wasn't really highlighted in the past. The US government has been working kind of behind this, to facilitate negotiations and stuff like that. But, no serious moves other than, some sanctioning individuals and stuff like that. But they've been very shy at naming these actors that are fueling the war, and because it ties back to a bigger policy and a bigger coalition that they have in the region. It's kind of, if you want to draw a parallel to what that coalition looks like, it's pretty much the Abraham Accords. It's, the new Middle East as was, coined by Netanyahu in 2023, that these countries are going to be the new Middle East, which is basically the Gulf Arab countries along with Egypt and Sudan. So it's this push. And even like when we go back to the transitional period from 2019 to 2021 under Prime Minister Hamdok, the US was heavily pressuring the transitional civilian government to normalize relationships with Israel. And when they refused and said that this is not something for a transitional government and it has to be a parliamentary decision, miraculously after that, the coup happened where Burhan and Hemeti both overthrew the civilian government. So, and when you start looking and kind of following statements and stuff during that time, US officials, Israeli officials were kind of, gave the green light for that coup. That coup is kind of what ultimately led to the war, because then you have SAF and RSF running the country since October 2021. And by April 2023, the war broke out between them. So it was like, okay, you can't blame this on anyone who, part of the civilian government or anything like that. This is solely the doing of these two forces. So when you look at who's backing them, then you start seeing why there's been silence around the war on Sudan. Sporadic reports here and there, but never a bigger breakdown of, Sudan kind of being an outpost of empire. And and this might be kind of, when you take the larger arc of Sudanese history and how things happened and where things are going from here, it really is, I think, a case of kind of, the empire, its outposts falling first before that collapse starts moving inward, to the centers of empire. But that's what Egypt and the UAE are. They're also, handlers of empire in the region, and that's I think, that's one of the reasons. And we can go back to other factors. The reason the RSF is as big as it is because things like the Khartoum process, where the European Union was funding the Khartoum government to quell migration, from the Sudanese borders to Libya, because a lot of people from the Horn of Africa go through Sudan to get to Libya and then cross the Mediterranean. You had the Yemen war. The Yemen war was Saudi and the UAE basically declaring war on Yemen and recruiting hundreds of thousands of Sudanese to go and fight over there. In the beginning, it was probably about like 30,000 fighters from Sudan, mainly from the RSF, going into Yemen. So it's these things that helped create this huge mess that we have right now, and it's been like in lockstep with Western policy in general.
And that's great, this huge humanitarian disaster we have today, which is interesting. You have the President Trump's special advisor, Mossad Boulos. He says that the parties in principle will accept a 3 months truce. That's what he recently said. Do you think that is possible? And also, considering what you've said about the connections, do you one can one take that with sincerity?
Well, I mean, nothing that comes from the Trump regime is going to be with sincerity. But because I think that even Egypt and the UAE They're looking at the destruction and the carnage and this huge humanitarian crisis. And they must be thinking, like, whatever plans they had in place for Sudan and whatever they wanted to do have crumbled, have now just completely been destroyed. Because the never-ending cycle of recruitment and violence and carnage that's been unleashed has kind of brought the country to a standstill. There's probably a lot of smuggling going on of goods, whether it's gold or livestock or anything like that. But there's no official economy. There's no functioning government. You have the de facto government kind of in Port Sudan, and now you have the RSF government, the ASIS in Niala. So you actually have a fragmentation of the country. And the biggest problem is that, the factions increased. Every day there's new factions popping up under the SAF umbrella. The RSF is heavily recruiting more. There's reports about them recruiting from like Chad and Niger, and so the spiral, like how much of the war spiraled out of control, I think it's way beyond what these countries wanted. So they are pressuring, like along with the US and Saudi Arabia, they are pressuring, but they still have their, their ties, their economic ties, and everything that they probably want to hang on to. And, that's only guaranteed by SAF and the RSF. So I think the US is, Mossad Boulos is not really a seasoned diplomat or a politician or anything like that. He's a businessman who was in Africa and, brought him on board, and it's probably they're negotiating the ceasefire. And on the long run, probably by directives from the Trump regime to get some economic wins out of it as well. Or just Trump wanting to say, I'll stop the war in Sudan and now, give me my Nobel Peace Prize. But the pressure is real. Like it seems like the pressure is real because now you're starting to see statements coming out of the SAF camp. The RSF has this trick where they always say that, yeah, we agree. We agree to a ceasefire. We agree to a 3-month pause. We agree to anything. And they know that, like, between that official agreement and what they're actually doing on the ground, like, there's a pretty long distance between those two. But SAF were outright refusing a lot of the conditions for the ceasefire. But the tone has changed a little bit. So I think there could be a humanitarian pause. But then now it's just the details. Because, SAF are asking for things like, the RSF to evacuate heavy populated areas, to back off from North Kurdufan and from other areas in West Kurdufan that they've advanced to just in the past couple of weeks. So I think we're going to be kind of going in circles within these kind of details in the next couple of weeks.
And as you said, there's been some change in what the SAF has been saying in terms of the negotiations. That SAF is the Sudan Armed Forces, and also the and as you mentioned, the contradiction of what the RSF, that's the Rapid Support Forces, says and does. And also, one of the things that is interesting, I saw in one of the reports in the Sudan Tribune about the recent meeting with Sisi, Fatah al-Sisi of Egypt, the president of Egypt, and Burhan, who is the head of the Sudan Armed Forces. If you could expand on that discussion or the meetings, if you have any information on that. Do you think that is one of the reasons why that you see some change because of the heavy influence the Egyptian military has had on the Sudanese military?
I don't know what, of course, like what was said within these meetings. But Egypt always wanted to walk that line where it's supporting SAF, but it doesn't want the country to split. Because that's not going to be in their interest at all. Even though there are some things like, Sisi kind of mediating between Haftar in Libya and Burhan. Burhan accuses Haftar in Libya of supporting the RSF, things like that. So the Egyptians are trying to kind of, control their immediate surroundings. So that includes, Eastern Libya, that includes Southern Sudan, Northern Sudan, the areas along the Nile, the Blue Nile and the White Nile. So it, Egypt kind of wants to maintain control over the central areas and the northern areas of Sudan primarily, and the eastern parts and southeastern parts as well. So Sisi, if I had to guess what Sisi is saying to Burhan, he's probably telling him that, hey, the RSF controls Darfur and part of Kordofan. You control the rest of Sudan. And overwhelmingly, the citizens in these areas of the east and the center and the west and the north, they're supportive of SAF. They would, or if you put it like this, they would much rather have SAF in their area, as much as it's repressive, than to have the RSF in their area. When citizens are faced with, they're going to choose the lesser of two evils. So Assisi is probably telling him that you have the upper hand when it comes to negotiations. You're the official army of the country. You are running the official, agencies within the government. Public opinion is mostly against the RSF. So go to the negotiations and put your demands. And that's why I think we're seeing these demands, very specific of, SAF asking RSF to back off from certain areas in Kordofan and to, to get out of the major cities to allow humanitarian access. So we're most likely going to see some conditions from RSF as well. On this, but I'm not sure what went on in those meetings, but that would be my guess, is a push to negotiations for a humanitarian pause or a ceasefire, and to put their conditions on the table.
And as you mentioned, the situation within SAF itself, and also this, and maybe I'll probably also connect this with the situation within RSF. Within those two entities which have gutted Sudan in the last 2 years, 2.5 years, and one could say even before that, by destroying the whole process of a civilian transition in 2021. You mentioned earlier about the splits within the SAF, Sudanese Armed Forces, the militias that are popping up. If you could expand a bit on that, and also, is it also similar situation within RSF? Is it a monolith, or is it also a similar situation where you're having certain entities propping up?
Okay. Well, with SAF, like the biggest problem with SAF is that at its core, there's a group of officers within SAF that are loyal to Bashir's party, the National Congress Party. These are hardline Bashir loyalists. They're theocratic. They believe in political Islam. They have been kind of there for all of these genocides in South Sudan, in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains. And they're suspectedly the ones that actually sparked this 2023 war. Because they've been in power for 30 years, they were removed by a popular movement. So the only way they could come back is by sparking a war like this, knowing that the RSF is ready and willing to, go into this war and, take over as much as they can. So those hardliners are always going to be against the war. That's one faction within it. There's the Darfur Joint Movement, Joint Forces, that include a lot of the Darfur rebels that were there in the 2000s. And they are seeing this as, okay, so the army kind of abandoned us in Al-Fashir, and they let Al-Fashir fall. So we have to collectively as Sudanese continue the war until we get rid of the RSF. But most likely, any kind of ceasefire or arrangement in the future that would maintain their kind of position within government. But more importantly, they would need guarantees for their constituencies, the millions of people who've been displaced in Darfur, and before this war and after this war. You know, they've paid a very heavy price. You know, their constituents have paid the heaviest price of the wars that are co currently going on in Sudan.
You're listening to a recent conversation on Sudan, looking at the tragedy in Darfur and more. And this is a conversation with Mousa Baba of Ayin Network, a media outlet in Sudan, and is also a member of the Pan-African Forum Sudan. The music in the background is Gurima by Chinewiso Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
The problem is also with SAF is that now you start seeing regional militias pop up. You know, there's a commander by the name of Abu Agla Kekel. Kekel was with the he was with the army before the war. When the war started, he deflected to the RSF. He's the one who brought the RSF into Jazeera State. Jazeera State is the state directly south of Khartoum. And after a while, he flipped back to the SAF camp and was treated as a hero, you know, even though he committed mass atrocities in Jazeera State. So he created his own militia called Dira Sudan, the Sudan Shield. And it's basically, you know, allied with SAF, but it's not under the SAF command. You know, we just saw last week a new Dir al-Sharik, the Eastern Shield. Now, this is another group that popped up in Eastern Sudan, and it's also the same thing, allied with SAF, but not under SAF. You know, you have Dir al-Shamal, the Northern Shield, led by a pretty shady character called the Jakumi, who just, you know, muscled his way and hustled his way into the transitional government. And now he's saying that, you know, Northern Sudan doesn't have a force that's protecting it. So we created a force, and same thing, not under SAF, but allied with SAF. These forces are exactly how the RSF started off, you know, allied with the government, but not under the command of SAF. So this has always been a huge point of contention. And one of the bigger problems as well is al-Barra ibn Malik Brigade. This is a straight up, like, hard line, you know, Islamist brigade that is early on said that we're not waiting for permission for SAF to go in. And they're directly connected to the Bashir regime Islamists. So that's once you start like unpacking the SAF umbrella, you're going to find so many problems that are not going to be solved with a ceasefire unless there's a comprehensive deal and negotiations to reform the security sector, which has to happen at some point in the future. But the more it's delayed, the more it's a problem. Within the RSF, it's, you know, the RSF recruits on a tribal basis. You know, they go to tribal leaders, to the traditional leaders, and tell them, hey, we need 300 or 500 of your youth. In return, you'll have protection. And, you know, you get a piece of the, like, the mining operations or the livestock operations, whatever economic operations they have going on in those areas. And this is how the RSF grew, you know, from being like a 70,000 person force to reportedly now close to a million, you know. And because basically, you know, there's different ways they use for the recruitment, but the general modus operandi for them is doing the tribal, you know, recruitment. The complication was that is that when you look at like Arab nomadic tribes from Darfur, they're cross border. So you have groups like the Rizegat who are in Darfur, but they're also in Chad. You know, you have the Hassaniya who are all the way out to like Mali and Mauritania and these areas. So that's one of the biggest issues that it's been like the RSF has almost an unlimited pool of recruitment for them, you know, just and being supported by the UAE for all this time, and controlling gold mines and cross-border gold mines, you know, within the Central African Republic and, you know, these areas, just gives them an unlimited supply of manpower. Now, I don't know how this is gonna play out now that there's a shift towards more using drone warfare. You know, we don't know how that's going to affect the numbers, but this push on Al-Fashir being, you know, they've been pushing on Al-Fashir for a year and a half, nonstop attacks on Al-Fashir, and a lot of deaths. You know, that's one of the things, one of the reasons why the RSF probably also is wants the ceasefire, because a lot of RSF soldiers have been killed. You know, and they've done a lot of killing, but they've also, you know, received a lot of killing, whether it's through conventional warfare or using drones on them as well. So that's kind of a breakdown of like what the both sides kind of look like right now.
Well, thanks for that comprehensive breakdown. And as you talked about the impact on the civilian population, and also in the context of how the civilian population has impacted politically, as you mentioned in the and when you were talking about the breakdown, how there's a need for a comprehensive solution. The missing piece has always been the civilians in Sudan. And what there's since really independence, the military has always intervened, and particularly in this last since 2019, when the civilians rose up against Omar al-Bashir, and then the military hijacked that process. Where are the civilians in the negotiations that are taking place under the umbrella of the what is called the Quad, which is the US, UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, and other arenas of negotiations? Are they being hijacked again as they were a few years ago?
Well, at this point, there's nothing to hijack, you know, and meaning that back then the popular movement like was w very widespread. You know, you had resistance committees, you had the Sudan's Professional Association that were basically the unions in Sudan. You had so many student movement bodies involved. You had, you know, neighborhood, you know, other than the resistance committees, you had also neighborhood committees that were more kind of service oriented. You know, you had IDPs, like huge IDP camps, like the Zamzam camp that we talked about earlier, and the Kutum, I mean, the Kelma camp in Niala. You had liberated areas like, you know, the SPLM North controlled areas in the Nuba Mountains and in Blue Nile. We're all on the same page, you know, as far as supporting a comprehensive change in Sudan that would give a more democratic and sovereign Sudan. The problem is, in 2019, this was kind of, you know, then funneled into a few political parties that have been controlling pretty much the transitional government of Abdullah Hamdok. Even Hamdok himself was a little handicapped and surrounded by all these political parties that wanted to cement their presence in the government. So there's been then a disconnect within the civilian camp, you know, between the elite political parties that were running the show and between the mass movement and the grassroots groups that were there. The grassroots groups, you know, once this war started, you know, a lot of them were doing, you know, the charity work, you know, the community kitchens, the emergency rooms, you know, the takaya, which is also a form of community kitchens, and things like that. A few of the youth have started doing more advocating for peace and stopping the war. You know, a lot of initiatives that, you know, displaced youth, whether in Cairo or Kampala or in Nairobi or in Addis, we're pushing for this. The political parties have gone through a change where the freedom and the forces of freedom and change were split in 2019, where SAF and the RSF were able to split them and take the Darfur movements to the side. Because in the beginning, like the political coalition had non-armed, urban civilian political parties, and it had armed groups like the Justice and Equality Movement, the Sudan Liberation Movement. We're all part of the same political coalition. Since that split in 2019, the political parties, the civilians, became weak because they were split from their armed movement constituents and their partners, and they were disconnected from the streets. And then the streets kind of, were just reacted to the coup and did protests. But then they got to a point where they had a charter for like the Sudanese revolution to start bringing and creating a revolutionary parliament and some very positive. The war, the political parties created something called Tagaddum, which is a coalition that includes political parties and civic actors. But that also got split because some of those politicians and civic actors went along with the RSF and stayed within a new body called Sumud. I mean, it's pretty confusing, but in general, the civilian front has been fragmented every step of the way until now. You have the civilians that are not included in any of these ceasefire talks or anything like that. The civilians, however, are involved in the African Union process. So if you think about like kind of the how the war is being dealt with as far as negotiations, and there's two tracks. The first track is what the US is doing with the Quad, and that just includes SAF and the RSF, just to come to a humanitarian pause, to work towards a ceasefire, and to work towards stopping it. But the Quad was very clear about SAF and the RSF cannot run the country after the war is done. And that's kind of one of the chicken and egg things where SAF and RSF are like, well, okay, if we're not going to run the country, then why are we going to go into a ceasefire? Until the human toll got to a large where it can't be ignored anymore, now they understand that this war can go on for another decade if they don't do a ceasefire. The second track is the track of the AU, where the AU is calling for a comprehensive political dialogue that would include all of the political factions, whether they're with the RSF, whether they're independent, whether they're with SAF, whatever it is, they civic actors as well, to have. Now, what that looks like right now in the beginning, like so far, what according to what I know, it's mostly the political actors. But the other civilian actors are not included in any of these platforms. So this includes the huge civil society in Sudan. That includes everything from teachers' unions to, resistance committees, to farmers' unions, to IDPs, to, liberation councils that are in the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile and these areas. So there's still a huge swath of civilians that are not included, in these processes. But at least a comprehensive political dialogue to figure things out, such as accountability, such as, day two from stopping the war, what's going to happen, the issue of governance. These things really have to be hashed out. The political dialogue is a start to it. But there needs to be a lot more attention to kind of widening that into more civic actors in Sudan that are on the ground and that have basically, they've faced the, you know, they've carried the burden of the war because they're the pretty much the closest to the victims of the war, which are the civilians.
Mosab Baba, thanks again for taking the time out of your hectic schedule to be with us and to unpack and give us a little bit more clarity on the tragedy in Sudan, particularly in the Darfur area. I'm sure we'll come back to you to discuss this issue further.
Thank you very much, Muiza. I appreciate the coverage as always.
And that was a recent conversation with Mosab Baba of Ayin network and media outlet in Sudan, and he's also a member of the Pan-African Forum Sudan. And in the conversation, he was dissecting the tragedy in Darfur and beyond in Sudan. In our final segment, we'll feature a portion of a poem from Sudan entitled Alien Suite by Safia El Hilo. And the poem was played at the Sankofa Video and Books' program, Sudan on My Mind, 2 weeks ago. It will be available on Sankofa's YouTube page. Here is Alien Suite by Safia El Hilo.
نسم علينا الهوى من مفرق الوادي يا هوى دخل الهوى خدني على بلادي. Fact. The Arabic word hawa means wind. The Arabic word hawa means love. Test, multiple choice. Abd al-Halim said, you left me holding wind in my hands. Or Abd al-Halim said, you left me holding love in my hands. Abd al-Halim was left empty, or Abd al-Halim was left full. Fairuz said, O wind, take me to my country. Or Fairuz said, O love, take me to my country. Fairuz is looking for vehicle, or Fairuz is looking for fuel. Kalthum said, where the wind stops her ships, we stop ours. Or Kalthum said, where love stops her ships, we stop ours. Kalthum is stuck, or Kalthum is home. Did our mothers invent loneliness, or did it make them our mothers? Were we fathered by silence or just looking to explain away this gaping quiet? Is it wasteful or wistful to pray for our brothers in a language they never learned? Whose daughters are we if we grow old before our mothers or for their sakes? They called our grandfathers the January children, lined up by the colonizer and assigned birth years by height. There is no answer because we come from men who do not know when they were born, who married women shown to them in photographs, whose children left the country and tried for romance and had daughters full of all the wrong language. One, at the musicians club in Omdurman, a singer is stabbed to death for playing secular music. The month before, a violinist on his way home is beaten by police, his instrument smashed to matchwood. All the bars in Khartoum are closed down. All the alcohol in Khartoum poured into the Nile. A new law forbids women from dancing in the presence of men. Another banned song lyrics that mention women's bodies. Two, at a party in Omdurman, lights strung among the date palms, my not yet mother, honey legs in a skirt, opens her mouth and the night air is the gap in her teeth. She sings in the lilting English to a slow song, while bodies around her pair off and press close. Before he is my father smokes a cigarette and shows all his teeth when he laughs. Wants to ask the dark gold girl how her English got so good, what the words mean, and could he sing something sometime into the gap in her teeth. But first, police arrive, rip lanterns from trees and fire a shot through the final notes of the song. And tonight, my parents do not meet. But I imagine Khartoum as it was in the 80s, my mother with ribbons in her hair, dress fanning about her nutmeg calves, my father, who I hear was so lively and handsome that only bad magic could have emptied that and filled him with smoke, the borrowed record player, the generation that would leave to make nostalgia of these nights, to hyphenate their children and grow gnarled by diasporas every winter. But tonight, Motown crackling in the hot twilight, mosquitoes swaying in the velvet dusk, my parents dance without ever touching. And now my mother harbors her country's music in her lungs. These songs, the only things she got in the divorce. There is a TV show we used to watch when we lived in Egypt, where a group of Sudanese youth sing old Sudani love songs. We don't get the channel here in the US. Tonight, my mother finds every episode on YouTube. After a quiet dinner of leftovers at the kitchen counter, because it's just us two, my brother is out being 21 and popular. My mother and I sit together in the half light and eat mango with our hands and listen to Asim al-Banna sing Fittif. And I never hear love songs like this in English. Songs that are as much about a country as they are about a woman. Songs where a woman is country. Before we grew bitter and learned not to make a world out of a person. learned not to make a world out of a country, because even your mother's country can betray you. My mother's country broke her heart, and I want to cry, picturing her eating mango alone in the dark, singing to herself. My brother and I are a world away, with our fast English and our hip-hop and our late nights. We are not from a world where love songs are like this. We are not romantic. We are not considerate. We forget to call. We do not bother to phone the cable people to ask for the channel with my mother's favorite show. We do not bother to teach her how to bookmark videos on YouTube, how to download all the old love songs into her iTunes, how to buy mango already sliced, packaged in neat plastic tubs. But the story goes, my father would never unwrap a piece of gum without saving half from my mother. The story goes, my mother saved all the halves in a jar. That's not the point. I'm not looking for anything serious, just someone to watch my plants when I'm gone. You can sing now if you want to. They're worried no one will marry me. I have an accent in every language. I want to be left alone, but that's not how you make grandchildren. I can't go home with you. Home is a place in time. That's not how you get me to dance. I'm not from here.
And that was a portion of a poem from Sudan entitled Alien Suite by Safia El Hilo. The poem was played at the Sankofa Video and Books program entitled Sudan on Our Mind 2 weeks ago, and it'll be available on Sankofa's YouTube page. Earlier on, you heard a recent conversation with Musa Baba of IN Network, a media outlet in Sudan, and he's also a member of Pan-African Forum Sudan. In the conversation, he was dissecting the tragedy in Darfur and beyond in Sudan. That's it for African Hour for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly focusing on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Gayempi. And that's followed by Convite La Kai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Clay Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Koza and Fonan Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan-Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And thank you for joining us. And also thank you for all the support you gave to Africa Now and WPFW during the recent fall pledge drive. We're going to leave the closing song entitled Rasa or Race by Milton Nascimento. And we play that remembering Milton Nascimento's birthday, which was on October 26th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. November's off-year elections have come and gone, and up and down the ballot, Democrats racked up major wins. In one of the most highly watched races, Virginia voters chose Abigail Spanberger, who will be the state's first female governor. Voters also chose State Senator Ghazala Hashmi, who will become the first Muslim woman in the U.S. to be elected to a statewide office. In New Jersey, Democrat Mikey Sherrill was elected governor. And in California, voters approved a new congressional map that could help Democrats pick up 5 additional seats in Congress in the 2026 midterms. In what was likely the most anticipated race, Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani took the win and is set to become the youngest New York City mayor in more than a century and the first Muslim to serve in that office. Ahead of the race, President Trump threatened to cut off federal funding for the city if Mamdani won, and in his victory speech last night, Mamdani made it clear he is not backing off.
Together, we will usher in a generation of change. And if we embrace this brave new course, rather than fleeing from it, we can respond to oligarchy and authoritarianism with the strength it fears, not the appeasement it craves. After all, if anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one.
In related news, Democrats see their success in yesterday's election as tied to anger over the shutdown. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
The government shutdown is now the longest in U.S. history as we now enter the 36th day. Yesterday's elections were not at all favorable to the president. He has himself identified the shutdown as a key reason for the Democrats' success. Trump responded with a very aggressive proposal that the 60-person filibuster in the Senate be ended, allowing legislation to pass with a mere majority. However, just this afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Thune ruled out this possibility, admitting that Trump held sway over many senators, but dismissing this as a realistic possibility.
And in more news, today the Supreme Court heard arguments on the legality of President Trump's sweeping tariffs. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
The case is about the massive tariffs which Trump has levied against virtually all U.S. trading partners since the start of his second term. He used the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose these tariffs, but many critics and judges have been skeptical about the reach of this law. No other U.S. president has ever used the Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose tariffs. Today, many of the Supreme Court justices appeared troubled by the fact that these tariffs raise revenue, a right which the Constitution specifically gives Congress. Trump's lawyers argued that the money raised by these tariffs are not the main purpose, but the tariffs are expected to raise $3 trillion over the next decade. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch had a fairly interesting point, that any attempt by Congress to reassert their trade power could easily be vetoed by the president. This means that any power over trade ceded to the president will likely never return to Congress, unless another body like the Supreme Court steps in. The president has a lot riding on this case. He said that it will be, quote, one of the most important and consequential decisions ever made by the United States Supreme Court, end quote. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWF.
Body like